Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Eight months ago, I went to this camp. It was nice. Jewish people, Arabs from some countries, some Americans, too. During those 40 days I spent there, those people became my friends.
We're joined by Jen Marlowe, an award-winning filmmaker, human rights activist, author, and playwright, to talk about her play, There is a Field. She's organizing dramatic readings of the play throughout the month of October to mark the life and tragic death of a young Palestinian peace activist. Asiel Asleh was a member of the group Seeds of Peace. He was shot to death by Israeli security forces while attending a peaceful demonstration. We asked Jen Marlowe to talk about the way this story of one young individual helps people understand the broader circumstances on both sides of the Mideast divide.
And that's where I think the power of art has, whether it's film or plays, in this case it's a play. You can only get at the larger picture, you can only get at the larger horror by examining and acknowledging and looking at an individual life. For me, this play is very personal because this young man was a friend of mine, and his loss was a traumatic moment in my life and a collective trauma in the community of Palestinians inside Israel. But why I believe this project is important is because I think that through the exploration of this young man's story, it's exposing the larger issues. And I think these issues in many cases are marginalized even within the Israeli-Palestinian discourse. People who are talking about the issues facing Israelis and Palestinians, the issues that are facing Palestinians who are inside Israel, the 20% of Israeli citizens who are Palestinians, as opposed to Palestinians who are in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, or in Gaza, their issues are marginalized inside the discourse as well as them being marginalized inside their own country. So I think the 10-year anniversary of this young man's death and the 12 Palestinian citizens of Israel who were killed in October 2000, so the 10-year anniversary, which is coming up this October, is an important opportunity to inject these issues into the larger discourse.
Talk about There is a Field and just tell us what the play is like and how you gathered the information as we understand it from discussing this with family and others.
There is a Field is done documentary style, and everything that's in the play, I would say that I less wrote the play than I culled it or edited it from many different primary source material, and predominantly it was a series of interviews that I did over an 8-year period with Asiel's family, largely with his older sister, whose name is Nardine. She's the central character in the play, and her struggle dealing with her brother's death and everything that brings out for her and everything that touches on in terms of the history and the identity and her experience as a Palestinian inside Israel comes out through these interviews. And that's the real backbone of the play. There are also interviews that I used for the play that I did with the other family members, Asiel's mother, his father, his younger sister, his younger brother, as well as Asiel's own writing. Asiel was a prolific writer, and there's everything from playful, funny, banter emails that he and his sister Nardine exchanged in the months before his death to very profound, reflective pieces of writing that he shared with his friends from Seeds of Peace, which is a community of Palestinian and Israeli young people who are seeking reconciliation together. And he was not just a member of that program, he was a star member. He was one of the leading members. So very beautiful, profound, reflective pieces of writing about conflict, about death, about what he saw his role being as a peacemaker. It intercuts and interweaves all of this together, also with transcripts from the testimonies of the policemen who were in Arabe, a few policemen who chased Asiel, one of whom who executed him. They lied on stand. All of them said they didn't know, they didn't see, it wasn't them, they don't know what happened. But we have their testimony as part of a commission of inquiry that the Israeli government had set up following the death of the 12 Palestinian citizens of Israel that happened in October 2000. Now, the results of the commission were largely a whitewash in many ways. None of the policemen who pulled the trigger in almost any of the cases of the people who were killed had any consequences. I mean, they are serving today, and in many cases have gotten promotions, but their testimonies exist, and their testimonies reveal a lot.
And why is it significant that you're writing about these deaths in the context of the Second Intifada?
On September 28, 2000, that's the date that's credited for the instigation of the Second Intifada. On that date, it was already the very end of what is now called the Oslo process. The Oslo Accords that had been signed in 1993 had initiated a peace process, and there had been, over the summer of 2000, final status talks. The hope was that they were going to resolve the big issues that had been left unresolved, and those talks broke down, and those were at Camp David. Those were in the summer of 2000. And frustration and anger were mounting because Palestinians were seeing that since the time these peace agreements had been signed, their expectations of their life becoming better, of things getting easier, of repression and oppression lifting, those had been their expectations, and what they actually found in reality was the opposite. Checkpoints mushroomed, settlements grew. So all during this period that was supposed to be about laying the groundwork for trust and good faith between the two sides, Palestinians saw more and more encroachment of their land and of their rights. So when those talks broke down, there was a lot of anger already and a lot of frustration. On September 28, 2000, Ariel Sharon, who at that time was the leader of the Likud party, leader of the opposition, well known as the champion of the Israeli settler movement, well known for having been found to bear personal responsibility for the massacres that happened in Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon, a very controversial figure. He made a visit to what Jews call the Temple Mount, what Palestinians call Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, which is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, and it was the site of the first and second temple. So a very, very holy site, both for Muslims and for Jews in the old city of Jerusalem. He paid a visit there in a very inflammatory time and a very inflammatory way, bringing with him, I believe it was 1,000 security officers. And it was a very clear political provocation. You know, my interpretation of his act was that he was saying, in the midst of the very sensitive question of who will get control of Jerusalem and, you know, will East Jerusalem be a Palestinian capital as West Jerusalem would be an Israeli capital, you know, he was making the point of saying, Israel has control of Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, and always will. I mean, that is what I believe is the subtext of what he was trying to do, which was intentionally inflammatory. And Sharon had the most to gain from a renewal of hostilities, as he was the leader of the opposition party. He was not in support of the Oslo peace process. It was in his political interest to see hostilities continuing. And that is what happened. Demonstrations erupted in Jerusalem the next day. I believe 4 Palestinians in Jerusalem were killed the next day, and the demonstrations spread to the West Bank and Gaza, and you know, every day demonstrators were killed by Israeli forces. Israelis were killed in the Second Intifada too, of course, but that actually didn't start happening until later. I mean, the first, a lot of people don't realize this, the first bombing of the Second Intifada was a car bomb that didn't happen until November 2nd, 2000. So it had already been over a month of when Palestinian demonstrators were being killed before the first bombing happened. During that time, demonstrations in the beginning of October, starting October 1st, also erupted inside Israel, in Arab Palestinian towns and villages inside Israel. And some people say the demonstrations were largely prompted in solidarity and in protest against what was happening in the West Bank and Gaza. Other people say that they also reflected a frustration and an anger at unequal conditions that Palestinians inside Israel were facing, discrimination inside Israel. And probably it's a combination of all those reasons. But the demonstrations were met with a level of lethal force. And again, you know, this was villages inside Israel. These were Palestinians who were Israeli citizens. And in those first 8 days of October, 12 Palestinian citizens of Israel were killed by Israeli security forces. And so October 2000 is known as Black October to Palestinians inside Israel. What happened to the Palestinians inside Israel during this time period, this is not a known part of the story. And even to Israelis, I'll talk to Israeli Jews and mention what happened, and people have forgotten, or they didn't know, or they knew at the time. But if they're 10 years later, if you're talking to someone about a seal, they may not have heard of him, and they may not really remember what happened in those communities inside Israel in October 2000. So it is in many ways a forgotten part of the story. Not, of course, for the communities for whom it affected. It remains as one of the largest communal tragedies. You know, there's a few massacres that happened since the founding of Israel, inside Israel, and Land Day, where six people were killed in 1976, is something that's memorialized every year, and now Black October is another very significant communal tragedy.
Talk about how those Israelis were killed by Israelis. What exactly happened?
In Asil's case, there was a demonstration that had been taking place just outside a village, and Israeli security forces, police, and then also border police came. Asil was a little bit off to the side watching the demonstrators. None of the demonstrators were armed. The only people with weapons at the demonstration were the security forces or the Israeli police officers. And Asil was standing a little bit to the side, and he was watching the demonstration. He was actually wearing his Seeds of Peace t-shirt, the t-shirt that he wore as part of being a member of this peace program. And I think he probably put that t-shirt on intentionally as a statement when he knew he was going to this demonstration, that was an intentional choice he made. He was watching, he was standing to the side. Three policemen started to charge him. And what we understand is that they had been given an order to make some arrests, and that's often one way that demonstrations will get dispersed is, you know, you catch a couple people, you arrest them, you know, everyone else scatters. They start charging towards the SEAL, who had been observing from the side. A SEAL turns and started to run towards an olive grove that was at the site of the demonstration. The policemen catch up to him and they're pursuing of him. As he's reaching the olive grove, one of the policemen strikes him with his rifle butt in the back, sort of the shoulder area of the back. A SEAL stumbled and fell. All of this we know from eyewitness testimony, including his parents, who were standing on a little hill observing the demonstration. They had gone to bring a SEAL home. They had been told that a SEAL was in the demonstration, and they wanted to bring him home, so they went. They were trying to find him. They could recognize him by the green Seeds of Peace t-shirt, and then they started to see this unfold. When a SEAL fell in the olive grove, then they couldn't see him any longer because the olive trees obstructed their sight, but they heard the shot. According to Asil's father, when the policeman then walked out and was visible again, walked out of the olive grove, he said, "You can come get him now." When they finally got him to a hospital in a town called Nahariya, which took a long time because initially the security forces wouldn't let an ambulance come, and they had to put him in a car and transfer him. There was checkpoints set up in roads all over Israel because there was demonstrations happening all over inside Israel. So getting him to the hospital was a long process, and whether or not his life could have been saved if he could have gotten there directly, we will never know that. But the doctor who did finally examine him said that the bullet entry mark had, you know, bore all the signs essentially of execution, of point blank fire and live ammunition. The Israeli security forces were using live ammunition as a demonstration dispersal method against its own citizens. There was another young man named Allah from Asil's village who was also killed that same day by sniper fire. There had been snipers dispatched as a form of demonstration control against Israel's own citizens.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, an interview with Jen Marlowe about her play, There is a Field. She's asking people to read it as a way of remembering 17-year-old Asil Asleh, buried in a t-shirt, celebrating the group Seeds of Peace, seedsofpeace.org. And we asked Jen Marlowe to talk about why this group was so important to him.
Seeds of Peace as an organization brings Israeli and Palestinian young people together, and it's an effort for them to, you know, meet each other, know each other, have dialogue with each other, and through dialogue, reach ways to work together to end the conflict. And Asil had started participating in Seeds of Peace in 1997. He had been selected as a member of the Israeli delegation and went to camp. And he was really the person inside the organization that educated everyone, not only his fellow campers, but also the staff. He educated all of us about the issues facing Palestinians inside Israel, because all of us were ignorant. you know, of course, they're part of the larger Palestinian community, but they've been cut off from that community in many ways by borders, being Israeli citizens. I mean, they have some struggles and some issues that are quite unique. What Nardine faces as a medical student, when she was a medical student in Haifa, was a quite different struggle than someone faces living in Gaza or Ramallah. And Asil taught us all about that and taught his Jewish Israeli colleagues in Seeds of Peace, educated them, and also educated Palestinians who were coming from the West Bank and Gaza, who also didn't necessarily understand the particular struggles that face Palestinians inside Israel. I can read, you know, one or two very beautiful emails that Asil wrote to his Seeds of Peace friends, exploring some of these questions and talking about what that meant to him and what being a peace activist meant to him.
Yes, please do.
And he wrote it on the anniversary of Land Day, which was March 30th, 1976. There was an expropriation of land happening inside Israel. Palestinians inside Israel demonstrated, and there were six Palestinian citizens of Israel who were killed on Land Day, which was March 30th, 1976. So Asil is writing this email in 1998, but on the anniversary of Land Day, and he's reflecting on what Land Day means and what his own role should be as a Palestinian, as a Palestinian who's inside Israel, and as someone who sees himself as a peacemaker. And this was maybe 8 months after he had first gone to Seeds of Peace camp. So this is meant for Israeli and Palestinian and international colleagues of his to read on his reflections of Land Day. This is called Peaceful Thoughts, and he writes, March 30th, 1976, nothing but anger that day brings to my people's mind. Yom al-Ard, they call it in Arabic, or the Land Day. Nothing but memories from that sad day when a group of Israeli soldiers tried to kick the local citizens out of the village. What village was that? It was my village, Arabe, they call it. But back then, people knew nothing but bloodshed and losing those who are close to them. As this day has come like any other year, I should fulfill my duty as an Arab and bring their memories to life. We should never forget, but we should forgive. 22 years since it happened, and each time people know nothing but madness and violence in that day. If I were a cop walking by, I think I should take another thought about walking in the uniform. All that anger, where did it come from? As for the years I saw, this anger came from the fathers to the fathers of those people. For somehow, most of us don't know what happened that day. Like I said, it became a duty. And it's our job to be there when they bring their memories to life. We should never forget, but we should forgive. They will say they fought bravely. They protected their land. They died for a reason. But I think nothing is worth dying for. But sometimes it's the only way to save others. What can I say for a mother who lost her son, or a sister who lost a brother? I stand powerless to bring them back, but powerful enough to bring their memories back by not forgetting them. 8 months ago, I went to this camp. It was nice. Jewish people, Arabs from some countries, some Americans too. During those 40 days I spent there, those people became my friends. Not for what they are, but who they are. I didn't see them as Israelis or Jordanians, but as Saad and Ned and Tim. They became my friends, and a heart is where you keep them. For 40 days, I learned who were those soldiers who tried to kick us out. And I learned who are those people that I lived with for 40 days. Now I know who are my friends. And a few years from now, they will become soldiers. They will go to the army to protect their families. But will they stay the same? Will they be the same Eddie or Tzachi that I knew? Will they be the same? What will happen if they become like those soldiers? And the duty will call them for what they call protection. What then? Will they be the same? That's an answer that only time can answer. But until then, they will be the same for me. The same people I lived with for 40 days, the same people I played with, the same people I shared with them my thoughts and feelings, and they did too. What I learned back in camp was priceless. We were all the same, so nothing else mattered. But what I learned in camp only showed up here 8 months later, today, in Yom al-Ard. Today I know what Seeds of Peace really gave me. I will know what to do when someone calls my friends killers or murderers. No friend of mine is a killer, and I'm not a friend of one either. Today, I will be asked to choose between what they call protecting and remembering, and between what they call forgiving. I will be asked to choose, and I will. Will my choice be the right choice, be the right thing to do, or will it be the wrong thing to do? Well, a friend of mine once said, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And I will be there, and I will see you when I get there. For the thoughts that are around me and the feelings that guard me, I won't forget a friend's words, and I will remember his words by making others remember mine. I will go on. I will make this planet a better place to live, and I will go on. For all the souls who only saw pain and sorrow in their eyes, for the souls who will never see a pain of another soul, I promise you, I will go on. Until we meet in the field, my friend, take care. Asiel Ousley.
This would have been a young man with tremendous promise, just a person who could have helped in so many ways on both sides of this horrible divide.
Absolutely. When they killed Asiel, they killed, you know, not only the person that he was on October 2nd, 2000, and already as a 17-year-old boy, he was more accomplished, you know, just an extraordinary human being. But they also, of course, and this happens when every life that is snuffed out prematurely through any violent impulse, you know, you take away all the potential of who that person could have been and what that person could have done. And in Asiel's case, there is no doubt in my mind that they took away an enormous potential, and that the loss of Asiel is a tragedy not only for all of those of us who knew him and loved him, but for all of those who would have known him and would have been touched and impacted by him and by his potential. And then you take that as the example of, you know, one extraordinary young man, but of course, all of the innocent victims are extraordinary, and their own potential has also been taken away by violence. And that, yes, this is one person, but in the story of that one person, we're reminded of how much this tragedy is compounded by, you know, all the people. We can't wrap our minds around, you know, we know that 1,300 people were killed in Gaza in December 2008, January 2009, but you can't wrap your brain around what that means. But one person's story can penetrate, and then you have to remind yourself to compound it.
Just talk about the meaning of all of this and the play in the context of today's headlines.
I think that right now what's happening in Jerusalem is absolutely the flashpoint right now and the tension point. I was in Jerusalem just a little over a year ago when it was the first families that they started evicting from their homes in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in order, and then Israeli settlers took over those homes. That's happening more and more, and many people see it, and I also see it as a very intentional effort to, you know, what is called Judaize Jerusalem. Israel does not intend to cede that any part of Jerusalem will go to a future Palestinian state, you know, if such a possibility could even exist now in terms of there being a viable future Palestinian state. And this is the same thing that's happened with settlements in the West Bank. One of the strategies that Israel employs is creating facts on the ground so that, you know, it looks like the future that they are trying to politically create, which would be a Jewish Jerusalem. And so they're doing that house by house, neighborhood by neighborhood, trying to find whatever different legal loophole or different ground they can stand on, pushing out Palestinian families and bringing in Israeli families. And the anger that's growing in Jerusalem is tremendous. One thing that I see happening, and I see it happening all over, I see it happening in Jerusalem, all over the West Bank, is that there is more and more response using direct nonviolent action. So the response in villages like Belin and Alin and Bujus against the wall that's being built, that's stealing so much of their village's land. The response that's happening in Sheikh Jarrah, I mean, all over, and it's in more and more places, you're seeing groups of Palestinians and Israelis and internationals who are working together using the principles of direct action, nonviolent resistance to stand up to these encroachments. And those efforts are met violently. Those efforts are met with violence. There have been a number of Palestinians who have been killed in the nonviolent protests. and Israelis and internationals who have been severely wounded. Tristan Anderson was, a year and a half ago, was shot with a high-velocity tear gas canister directly in his forehead at one of the nonviolent demonstrations in Al-Ain and survived but remains brain damaged, just as one example of one case. To Rachel Khoury, which was an earlier incident in March 16, 2003, in the Gaza Strip, when she was nonviolently trying to offer protection to a Palestinian family's home that was facing threat of demolition by Israeli military bulldozers. So despite the fact that there is increasing levels of repression and violence against this nonviolent movement, it actually seems to be really burgeoning and really growing in ways that I find exciting, because I think ultimately that is going to be how any kind of progress is made. I think it's only going to happen when Israelis and Palestinians working jointly together on the ground, using principles of nonviolence, when they bring it about.
Listeners can find Jen Marlowe's project online, her call to theatrical action, at donkeysaddle.org. Jen Marlowe, how far along is this project? Do you have interest at this point?
Oh, there's been a phenomenal response, a very exciting response. The play has not yet been read because the call, of course, is for the world to do this simultaneously throughout the month of October. So right now, it's all the plans of organizing the readings. So far, we've had interest expressed from people in 30 different cities in 15 different countries, and it's continuing to grow. DonkeySaddle.org, I'm updating that every day with new information, new readings, people who are interested. But now there are translations of the play happening in Hebrew, in Arabic, in Spanish, in Russian, in French. And again, that's just the start. I think before we reach October, there'll be more and more. Some of the productions and readings that I'm most excited about are happening in Zimbabwe. There might be one in Kenya. In the United States, there are going to be readings in Minneapolis, Seattle, New York, Los Angeles. There's going to be a reading in Jerusalem, in Palestine, at Al-Hakawati Theater, which is the Palestinian National Theater. So I'm very excited about that. You know, it's spreading, and I hope it will continue to spread. And like I said, there might be folks who don't have the time or, you know, aren't able to organize a public event. But participating in this call to action can be as simple as inviting a few friends to your house, having copies of the script, which I will email to anyone who wants them, and sitting and reading it together, and then talking and thinking about all the questions that it raises. We want to know every corner of the globe, every city, every town, every community, every living room that is going to be participating in this global call for theatrical action.
Jen Marlowe, congratulations on another bold production, and I wish you the very best of luck with it.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Jen Marlowe has done conflict resolution work with young people in the Balkans, the Middle East, and Africa, where she made her award-winning film Darfur Diaries, Message from Home. Her second feature film is Rebuilding Hope, about Sudanese-American young people on their first trip back to Sudan to find relatives and fulfill a dream to build a school. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for an audio archive of our shows. Our music is by Fritz Heed. Underwriting for the program is brought to you by JeremyRHammond.com, political analysis from outside the standard framework. He is founder and editor of ForeignPolicyJournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award. New at JeremyRHammond.com, the piece Turning Back from the Point of No Return, Implications of the Threat to Bomb Iran.